Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. The 2018 midterms were just 4 months ago, but already states are taking stock of the biggest election-related issues that might impact 2020, from how campaigns are financed to who gets to vote. At New Hampshire's State House, there are nearly 60 bills that propose changes to just about every aspect of the election process. And around the country, concerns about voting technology, ballot access, ballot integrity, and redistricting are playing out in courts and in state legislatures. Today in The Exchange, what do these voting-related battles say about our attitude toward the political process, and what impact might they have on next year's elections? Let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. What changes to our voting laws or systems would you like to see? Again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me for the hour, Casey McDermott, NHPR reporter covering politics and policy with a focus on data and accountability. And Casey, thank you very much. Really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from New York, Jessica Huseman, reporter for ProPublica. Her work has appeared in Electionland, ProPublica's collaborative journalism project, covering voter access, cybersecurity, election integrity. Jessica, really nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Casey, you've reported that there are nearly 60 bills in the State House this year related to elections. Wow, that's a lot. What are some of the key themes that keep coming up in these bills?
So some of them are perennial, and those have to do with who can vote in New Hampshire. So basically defining, or in some cases rolling back, definitions around residency standards or domicile standards, which basically means, you know, proving where whether you live where you're trying to vote in New Hampshire. But then there are other kind of more systemic changes that we're looking at, whether that's legislation concerning the equipment that's used to count ballots, legislation concerning who works at the polls, how those people are appointed, what qualifications they have. But then also on the candidacy side of things, there are some interesting bills looking at, you know, how candidates are able to run for office, both at the state level and also with an eye toward 2020 at the presidential level.
Wow. So some of these bills are rehashes of issues that you and I have talked about,
yes,
I don't know, 100 times, Casey.
I think that's about an accurate estimate.
You know, who can vote, where they can vote, you know, college students voting, people who don't have a fixed address voting, what kinds of proof you have to show when you show up at the polls and all that.
Exactly. And there's actually, I mean, there are some new-ish, or at least, you know, new in terms of they haven't necessarily been at the forefront in recent years, pieces of legislation on that. And one that caught my eye that was interesting has to do with an issue that we are actually seeing around the country concerning felon enfranchisement. So in New Hampshire, you are able to vote if you have a felony on your record, if you've served out your sentence. But one of the things that I think activists have noted is that sometimes people don't know that they're actually able to vote if they have a criminal record. So there's a bill out there right now that would require the Department of Corrections to do more education informing people of their right to vote upon completing their sentence, and then would also just clarify the language around the state's eligibility standards to make sure that it says that a person who's on probation or parole can vote too, because that's also an area of confusion.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. So, Jessica, staying big picture for a moment, please. What are the two or three major themes that you've been covering lately as states continue to debate their voting laws?
You know, I think that one of the big things that that is frequently overlooked as a major issue in voting is the procurement of voting machines. So I'm taking a closer look at that. There have been a lot of really interesting updates to both federal standards and the desires of states in this process, and they really occasionally will radically alter the way that voters know how to vote and can vote. So we're taking a bigger look at that, and the differences between the states are widely varied, so it's kind of hard to encapsulate what states are doing in a sentence. But, you know, I think that the other thing is the way that states are approaching voter registration is also pretty interesting. There are a lot of states that are moving towards automatic voter registration and online voter registration, which are two big movements towards making voting and voting registration a lot more accessible for voters across the country.
Wow. Online voter registration. So we should definitely talk about that. And it seems like, just listening to you, Jessica, and Casey as well, there's a couple big categories. Jessica, I'll turn to you first. One is the actual technology or machines or sort of physical infrastructure involved in voting. Another is sort of who can vote and who can't. And then a third that I think we'll tackle is sort of security, cybersecurity. We don't want our elections to be hacked. There was a lot of concern about that in 2018. So those seem to be the big categories, Jessica, that are out there. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think that you're exactly right.
So at the state houses that you cover, Jessica, and I know there's a lot, are this year's bills, as Casey referenced, are some of them more the same, you know, the same old debates, but now that Democrats are in charge, they're trying to roll back some of the changes that Republicans made? I mean, is that what you're seeing?
You know, I think that I have been surprised at how attentive to voting issues voters are across the country. I think that there is, you know, especially in the type of work that I do, which is all investigative, you tend to focus on the negative. And there are certainly bills that would restrict voting or promote things like voter ID, even in states where they haven't really noticed any type of fraud that would be prevented by voter ID. But I think what I have been most surprised about this year and in the 2018 election is how much of a hunger there clearly is from the electorate to open up voting laws. You know, we had five states pass pretty significant measures in terms of opening things up, so automatic voter registration or turning things over to councils in order to do redistricting instead of political redistricting. So all of these things are really interesting sort of signs of progress that you can see in voting, which haven't really gotten a lot of attention in the national media, but I think are really progressive things. And even in Republican states, you're seeing this sort of thing. So, for example, Florida re-enfranchised thousands of formerly convicted felons this past year, while simultaneously electing a very conservative Republican governor. So I think, you know, this attitude towards expanding the franchise is becoming bipartisan, and that's a really interesting thing to watch play out on a national level.
Well, before we get into some of the details about redistricting and some of the other changes that both of you have touched on, Casey, just this week at the State House, what is going on in terms of these voter bills? Because, as you know, this is a really busy time at the State House
it
where the
is.
House and Senate have to hand over their bills to each other. So what's happening just this week, Casey?
So I think the big, probably the one that is most closely watched right now actually hits on an issue that Jessica mentioned, which is automatic voter registration. So there's a bill up in the Senate this week, tomorrow, that they'll be voting on that is called Establishing the Secure, Modern, Accurate Registration Act. So people are calling it the SMART Act. And basically, the way that this would work is it proposes linking the DMV databases with the election databases that are used in the Secretary of State's office and allowing those to talk to one another so that if someone goes into the DMV and, for example, registers a vehicle or asks for a driver's license, that information that's captured in the course of that registration would automatically be sent to the Secretary of State's office. There would be provisions for people to opt out or for there to be kind of, you know, a review process at the local level, as there always is in New Hampshire when someone registers. So it wouldn't just be, you know, someone goes to the DMV and they're automatically on a new checklist. But the goal from supporters is to provide more opportunities for people to register outside of town hall or outside of election day.
So they're at the DMV anyway,
yes.
So why not? That
yeah.
goes the thinking.
Yeah.
So Let's turn to just some of the mechanics of voting, because this is really interesting. We've spoken for so long here in New Hampshire, just to let you know, Jessica, about bills concerning, you know, who can vote and who can't. And again, voter ID and what you need to show at the polls and so forth, and concerns about voter fraud. But it's interesting. You guys wrote in ProPublica that actually in 2018, I'm quoting here, instead of fireworks from voter intimidation or cyber attacks, Americans grapple with the mundane frustrations of using dated equipment to vote in huge numbers. So it turns out, Jessica, the technical stuff was a very big deal. What happened?
Oh, lots of things happened. You know, one of the biggest issues that we saw, for example, was in New York City. The scanners that they use to process the ballots that are hand-marked went down because it was raining. That is a true story.
Wow.
So the scanners are very sensitive to humidity and can only accept a certain thickness of paper. And so because paper swells when it's wet outside, they had a lot of issues processing those ballots in a timely way. And so they had to, and I think they did it in kind of a deft way, but they moved very quickly towards hand counting ballots because the machines that they'd paid millions of dollars for just stopped working. But I think more broadly across, I mean, that's a very specific incident and one that probably should have been tested prior to running. I mean, it does rain in the United States.
Right.
So that was a bit of a surprising problem. But, you know, I think that the last time that the United States really gave a lot of funding towards re-upping voting machines and voting equipment was in 2002 with the Help America Vote Act and the millions of dollars that were dispersed to states through that act. And you can imagine that, you know, 16, 17-year-old technology is just going to start failing. And that's honestly what we were seeing across the country. We were seeing voting machines that stopped working, voting machines that had screens that were miscalibrated. I don't know if any of your listeners have ever used a really old ATM, for example, where you hit a button, but the button 2 inches over presses instead because the touch screen is miscalibrated, because older versions of touch screens needed to be calibrated every few hours. And so voting machines that are widely in use today are older than the first iPhone, and no one would want to use the first iPhone. So I think none of the problems were unexpected, but because our voting infrastructure is incredibly old, these problems just popped up across the country and really did cause problems for voters in terms of, we had 4-hour-long lines in Georgia, for example, because of issues with their voting machines.
Wow. Wait, Jessica. Sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. 4 hours in line?
You know what? And 4 hours is actually one of the shorter lines.
Okay. I couldn't wait 4 hours. I've got, you know,
no,
a family and a job.
No one can. And that's really the insidious part of this, is that our outdated technology is making it hard for people to vote, because I certainly couldn't wait 4 hours to vote. And I'm a salaried employee. There are hourly employees that would literally be sacrificing time on the job in order to wait in line for that long.
Or senior citizens who can't, you know, stand up that long and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm glad you mentioned 2002 and the Help America Vote Act. How much is the shadow, Jessica, of the 2000 elections hanging over this discussion about physical infrastructure? You know, the debacle we saw in Florida, where because of flaws in the system, we didn't know for days and days and days who our next president was going to be. How much are people sort of thinking about that still?
You know, I think people are really thinking about that a lot. And I think that what I've heard from election administrators across the country is that they're sort of kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop and for that sort of thing to happen again. And I think that technology around voting in terms of methods of counting and methods of auditing have become a lot smoother since 2002. So I don't know that anything of that magnitude would happen again. But certainly if we're talking about, these very aged machines without federal or meaningful state funding, then we're going to get ourselves into a situation in which the system entirely breaks down. Because relying on this type of technology almost totally for voting creates a lot of potential breakpoints.
Well, and Casey, I want to ask you about New Hampshire because we still use paper ballots, so maybe we don't have the touchscreen issue, but what technical issues have come up in New Hampshire's elections?
Sure. So, you know, our Secretary of State is actually fond of saying you can't hack a pencil. That's kind of a refrain that you hear from Secretary Gardner when describing, you know, the office's posture on issues of cybersecurity or the state's, you know, relative lack of technology in its voting systems relative to other states. But it is important to note that there are actually a number of ways in which voting in New Hampshire intersects with technology, even if in most cases voters are checking in on a paper checklist by poll workers using a pencil and they're going into a voting booth and using a pen or a pencil to cast their ballot. So, for example, Jessica was referencing the actual machines used to count the ballots here in New Hampshire. The state is responsible for approving the machines that can be used at the local level. And right now there's only one machine that's approved for use and it's actually no longer on the market. So what local officials...
Hang on, that seems like a glitch.
Well, what that has resulted in is that local officials, if they end up needing to, you know, replace a machine or repair it, have to really kind of cobble together spare parts from either other states or other municipalities to fix the machines because by law, they're not allowed to use a newer machine. So there is a piece of legislation that's before the legislature this year that initially would have required the Ballot Law Commission, which is the group that's responsible for approving that equipment, to approve new machines once every 5 years. That has since been amended to require the commission to at least every 5 years review the devices to determine whether they require upgrading. So a little bit less definitive there, but this is definitely an issue that if you talk to any clerk, and in particular those that oversee elections in cities or larger polling locations where there's a lot of people, a lot of ballots being processed, you hear about a number of instances where on election day, I had the Manchester City clerk tell me that they experience breakdowns pretty much every election, or at least slowdowns in the machine's ability to process the ballots.
Wow. So let's just super clarify this case, Casey, for everybody. So again, there's one type of machine that the state of New Hampshire says towns can use.
Exactly.
That's been vetted, and the state thinks that it's the best.
Mm-hmm.
But that machine isn't on the market anymore. So when it breaks down, elections officials have to, I don't know, go on Craigslist or eBay?
I don't know that it's that rudimentary.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a supplier in the state that I think works with local municipalities to help them track down those parts. But of course, you know, if you have an old car or a kind of, you know, very unique car that doesn't, you know, that isn't made anymore, then think of it that way. It's difficult to track down and sometimes expensive to track down parts for those vehicles. And in a similar way, you know, it's challenging for communities to be able to track down those parts for their voting machines. One other thing that I think is important to note is that from a funding perspective, the burden falls on local communities to pay for that kind of equipment. So while the state says you can only use this one thing, and while, you know, that one thing might not be on the market anymore, the communities are the ones that have to budget for making repairs or making upgrades or replacing those machines within their own kind of town and city budgets.
Today in The Exchange, we are looking at election-related legislation here in New Hampshire and around the country, from who gets to vote to the very physical aspects of voting, including the machines. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Jessica, talking about funding, is the federal government stepping up at all to help states and localities pay for better equipment? I'm really struck by what I'm hearing from you and Casey about this.
You know, the short answer is no, but there is a little bit of nuance to that. So last year, the Election Assistance Commission, which is the only federal agency that really assists local elections administrators, dispersed about $380 million and for states to use for their election infrastructure in whatever way that they felt was most appropriate, with some you know, broad requirements. But that was not new money. That was just leftover money from 2002. So the long story short, the federal government hasn't actually allocated any new money towards this problem. Certainly, there have been efforts at the federal level that have been more adequately funded for federal election infrastructure and security. DHS has, for example, really ramped up their election security protocols and procedures. But in terms of helping states fund new machines or new equipment, that has yet to happen.
So what's the answer for these states, Jessica? They just throw their hands up and say, sorry, voters, you're just going to have to wait 4 hours? I mean, that just doesn't seem acceptable to people.
So states are, I think, rising to the occasion in certain instances. So, you know, there are certain states that are making really big pushes towards introducing new equipment. Georgia, for example, is preparing to spend $150 million on new machines. That, unfortunately, followed a lawsuit. And now they're having issues with potentially preferring one vendor unfairly. But, you know, I think that there are other states, for example, that have, in applying for their part of the $360 million, have said that they will match those funds. So I think that there are states that have really decided that this is part of a larger problem that does need to be addressed. But I also want to point out that New Hampshire is interesting because the state does require these very specific things with voting machines that, as Casey mentioned, are holding some of the especially larger counties back. There are quite a few states that do not have any control over what the counties do or do not do with their voting machines. So in a lot of states, this is entirely at a county level to decide. Well, they might take state funding. There are very few mechanisms under law in many states, for example, Kentucky or Texas or Kansas, for the state to require that counties purchase new machines or that they update existing ones. So, you know, we like to think about elections as being run by the 50 states, but they're actually run by thousands of counties, which makes updating broadly this equipment a difficult task to do on a national level.
Wow, really interesting. Casey, go ahead. I can see you want to jump in.
Yeah, just on the subject of New Hampshire and on the subject of how funding is raised and spent, I thought kind of a unique illustration of the challenges that local communities in New Hampshire are under and how they're kind of finding creative ways to work around it. We saw play out in Bethlehem, which is a small town in northern New Hampshire, last fall, where a group of community members who saw that it was taking, even in their relatively small town, hours upon hours upon hours to count the ballots at the end of every election, they got together and actually organized a crowdfunding campaign where they had this kind of fundraising event called Ballots and Beer at a local event space. And they raised, you know, the $4,000 that they needed to buy a new voting device for their town. So that's, you know, one example of the ways in which communities have tried to get creative in how they find money for this. But I think that also illustrates the lack of support that they get from the state level in terms of actually affording the devices they need.
Well, we've got an idea from one listener about improving the counting process. Jeff in Hillsborough says, I think as a country, we should go back to counting ballots by hand in all of our elections. Our grandparents used to wait a couple of days before they knew the results of elections. They survived just fine. We would too. Jeff says the demands of instant gratification should not outweigh the need of all ballots being counted correctly. Jeff, thanks for the email. We'll take more of your emails after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Hey, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. You trust the journalists you hear on NHPR because you know they follow a strong code of ethics. You know that they're working in your interest. The people who use this service are the most important single source of support for this service. Your $10 a month gift fuels this award-winning station that keeps you and your neighbors across New Hampshire in the know. Become a sustaining force for NHPR. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, after the 2018 elections, many states are taking stock of election-related issues that might impact 2020. We're looking at some of the major trends here in New Hampshire, from debates over ballot access and integrity to concerns about old technology. We're getting a national picture, too, and let's hear from you. What changes in our voting laws or systems would you like to see? What experiences have you had at the polls that inform your thinking? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Joining us from New York, Jessica Huseman, reporter for ProPublica. Her work has appeared in Election Land. That's a collaborative journalism project covering voter access, cybersecurity, election integrity. With me in studio, Casey McDermott, NHPR reporter covering politics and policy with a focus on data and accountability. And both of you, Casey, you first, let's tackle another big angle of this topic, and that's the idea of ballot access or ballot integrity. This has been huge in New Hampshire. But what does ballot access really mean, Casey? What specifics does it encompass?
Sure. So, I mean, I think the most simple way to think of it is, what does it take for a voter who wants to participate in an election to actually get the ballot to be able to participate in that election? So that can cover everything from where their polling place is located to what hours that's open to, you know, in some cases, the lines that may or may not pile up at a polling place that might make it difficult, as we were talking about a few minutes ago, to be able to take the time out of your day to cast a ballot. But then on a more granular level, it also addresses what do you need to show or prove in order to have the poll worker who is working at the polls give you a ballot to be able to participate. So that's where the things like voter ID or other standards around residency rules, which have been, I think, more at the forefront in New Hampshire in recent years, come into play.
Now, that's really interesting. So it's a lot more than just voter ID and voter registration. It's, are the polls open long enough for you to get there? Are the lines so long that it's ridiculous and you can't do it? So ballot access kind of encompasses a lot.
Yeah. And it can also, I mean, just to add another layer to it, it could also encompass what a state's rules around early voting or absentee voting are. So we're seeing a push in New Hampshire this year to open up no excuses absentee voting. We are among a group of states that requires you to have a state sanctioned excuse to be able to cast an absentee ballot, whereas other states we're seeing are moving in a direction of saying, you know what, if you want to vote absentee, you can do it. We'll make that happen for you without requiring you to attest that you meet certain qualifications in order to do that.
Jessica, is ballot access more a Democratic talking point, or is it something that politicians from both parties talk about?
I guess it depends on what you mean by a talking point. So I think that the Democratic Party is more widely seen as opening the ballot up to more people. But if you talk to folks in the Democratic, or if you talk to folks in the Republican Party, they would say that many of these things may open us up more deeply to fraud. And so depending on which talking point you're going with, they both are concerning themselves with it. I think that the Democratic Party is the one pushing for more access.
And Republicans talk a lot about ballot integrity, Jessica, sort of, you know, reflecting concerns that people are voting twice or that people are voting in districts where they shouldn't vote. I wonder what you hear about that around the country.
You know, I think that there is that overreaching concern, especially from more conservative politicians. But, you know, I think that it's interesting that they only want to talk about specific types of fraud. So, for example, Mitch McConnell stood in front of of Congress and claimed that if North Carolina had just had voter ID, then maybe the widespread election fraud that we saw in North Carolina's 9th district may not have happened. Of course, that is objectively false, and the type of voting that was sort of fraudulently pushed in North Carolina had nothing at all to do with voter ID, and those voters would not have been forced to show ID. It was all in collecting ballots that they mail in from home or that are harvested door to door, which is not the type of fraud that you can prevent with voter ID. So, you know, I think that there are issues of election fraud across the country, and they specifically happen in these situations where people go door to door to collect ballots or, for example, go to nursing homes and collect ballots. And we see those every year, but there's very little legislation written to address those those things, whereas there is legislation to address voter impersonation, which almost never happens. It would be far more likely that you could stand in front of your polling place and get struck by lightning than that someone would go to a polling place and pretend to be somebody that they are not. But that is the type of fraud that gets the most legislation, and not other far more common types.
So ballot, and I read you guys' reporting on that. So it seems like you're saying the real frontier to tackle with election fraud is absentee voting. That's where some of the mischief happens.
Yeah, it can be. You know, I think that there are certain states that don't have a lot of security around ballots that are mailed in. So if you look, for example, at a state like Colorado, which is entirely mail ballots, they have quite a bit of security in place for the way that ballots are sent to voters and are sent back for counting. They are constantly tracked. They have very specific agreements with the Postal Service in terms of how they must be sent. But then there are states that don't really address those things or don't provide the technology that would be required to know where the ballot is at any given time. And so these open themselves up to a lot of issues like ballot collecting in fraudulent ways. So I think that there are things that states can do to make these issues more secure. And I certainly don't think that the answer is stopping mail-in ballots or stopping absentee ballots. But I think that states have a lot to learn in terms of making those processes more secure. And they can start in a place like Colorado, which has set up a lot of really interesting sort of firewalls to prevent fraud in their mail-in ballot system.
Let's go to our listeners. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. As we look at the many changes states are considering about their voting systems, their election systems, we'd love to hear from you what changes in New Hampshire's voting laws or technology or aspects of the ballot box would you like to see? Let us know. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. And Casey and Jessica, let's go to our listeners. Mike is calling in from Walpole. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You just touched on it, but I was curious, given it seems that an awful lot of the fraud does take place around absentee ballots, how much of the legislation that's been proposed currently is designed to deal with that?
Yeah, Mike, thank you so much for the call. Casey, go ahead.
I can't give a kind of definitive answer offhand other than to say that I don't think that we have anything that specifically looks at absentee ballot requirements in terms of the security of them. But what we do have are other pieces of legislation that would address, you know, how often the checklists are updated or what kind of information is updated into the checklist system. So, for example, that automatic voter registration at the DMV that we discussed before, proponents of that have said that moving toward that kind of a system where you link it to a DMV or something that is updated on a regular basis and includes information that could help you verify the authenticity of someone who's casting a ballot would allow the state's election systems to be updated on a more routine basis and have the information that they need in there as a backstop to those ballots. One other thing that's worth mentioning in New Hampshire is there have been other issues that have come up around absentee ballots that have been addressed through legislation in recent years. So we had a system, and I believe this is something that was an issue in other states as well, where if you submitted an absentee ballot and the signature on that ballot did not seem to match the one that you used on your registration form, then it was at the discretion of the person counting those ballots, but they could toss that ballot and not count it. And that resulted in a federal lawsuit and the state being ordered to reform that system.
That's
so,
right.
Yes.
I remember, was it the ACLU that
it
brought
was,
the lawsuit?
Yes.
And
yeah.
Saying that older people especially, yeah. As you get older, your handwriting
yeah.
changes?
One of the plaintiffs was a woman who I believe was in her 80s who was legally blind. And so that obviously presents issues for people in that situation. So I think the big picture is that there are a lot of issues around absentee voting that present logistical challenges and also kind of verification challenges. And I anticipate seeing more attention paid to that in New Hampshire in the years ahead.
That's really interesting. And I'm thinking we could do almost a whole hour just on absentee voting. So, Mike, I'm going to set it aside for now, but I really appreciate the phone call. Up next, both of you, we have a representative from Manchester calling in, Representative Klein Knight. Good morning. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Go ahead. You're on the air. Yeah.
Well, I walked a lot this summer, knocked on a lot of doors in my neighborhood, and I was surprised to talk to a lot of ex-convicts that told me point blank that they could not vote. And that, in fact, is not true. Once you are on parole, if you're out of prison, you can vote. And everyone on the Criminal Justice Committee didn't know that either. It was very confusing. So I'm glad to say with bipartisan support that felon voting rights to clear up the definition of the law passed. And we voted on the House floor and it also passed. And I'm really excited to see, more responsibility to education in that.
So, Representative Klein Knight, I'm glad you called in. And did you say you were on the on one of the relevant committees on this issue?
I wrote this bill.
And, okay.
I'm actually on the Transportation Committee, which, funny enough, we just passed the Social Security. If you don't have a Social Security card, you can get a driver's license and talk about registering to vote if, voting fraud came up. If you are not, in fact, a citizen, you could still potentially vote with a driver's license. So that was a good conversation as well.
Okay. Well, Representative, thank you for calling into the show today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
There were a couple other issues I wanted to ask you about, Jessica, in terms of this topic of ballot access, whether that's, as Casey said, how long you wait at the polls or what kind of ID do you have to show. We've done a lot of coverage here on The Exchange about voter ID. How many states now have voter ID? I mean, all states you have to show ID to register. But how many states now have voter ID laws where you have to actually show your driver's license at the polls?
So about 35 states have voter ID laws, and those vary in sort of the type of ID law that you have to have. So, for example, some states strictly require you to present only a photo identification that is issued by that state or the federal government. There are other states where you could, instead of a photo ID, present two forms of ID, like, for example, your water bill and also your and also a student ID or something like that. So they vary by state in terms of their severity, but about 35 total have them.
Okay, so that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Casey, we've gone back and forth about voter ID in this state. Where does it stand now? I think you alluded to this earlier in the show that there are some bills in the legislature that look at flipping some of the voter ID laws we have.
And this is a pattern that will be familiar to anyone who has followed the State House and the debate over voting issues for the last really decade or more. One of the things that I have observed and that I'm sure others have as well is that this is really kind of a pendulum-like pattern of when, when Republicans are in control and in the majority as they were the last 2 years, you will see a lot of movement to tighten voter residency standards, to add new ID restrictions. And then when the Democrats regain the majority, they come in and their priority is to roll those back. So that's what we're seeing this year. The Republicans were in charge last term, Democrats are in charge this term. And consequently, what we're seeing is Democrats really rallied around, I think, a lot of the enthusiasm that Jessica was mentioning from voters on issues of voting access and, voter ID issues. And they have made a lot of movement to just basically reverse the changes that the Republicans put in place in the last 2 years. So those changes, chief among them, are one bill that would require people who are registering within 30 days of an election to provide documentation that they live where they're trying to vote. And then there's another rule that would basically eliminate the distinction between domicile and residency in New Hampshire. And this has been a perennial issue, but it would require people who vote in New Hampshire to then comply with all of the other applicable laws that apply to residents. So this was of particular concern for example, out-of-state college students, but also anyone who's really kind of transient for either employment purposes or personal reasons. So those were some of the issues that we've seen. Both of those Republican laws are not only being challenged at the State House by Democrat lawmakers, but they're also being challenged in court.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Casey, a purely logistical question for you. You've talked to poll workers before. Let's say these bills to reverse voter ID and registration requirements pass, and they might not because Governor Sununu might veto them. He was a big supporter of these laws. But let's say they pass, then what do poll workers do? I mean, they've already taken a significant amount of time to get up to speed on what they need to do under the new system of voter ID. So then what?
So it would depend on what poll worker you're talking to. I think that one of the things that we saw when those Republican laws were being debated in the legislature, and then also in some cases in court, local poll workers actually testified, both in court and at the State House, that those laws were overly complicated and were making their life, which, you know, frankly, it is not easy to be a poll worker in New Hampshire or anywhere else
in
the
country. And a lot of these people are volunteers,
right? A lot of them are
right?
volunteers. A lot of them are often, you know, older, have to get up to speed on different types of technology that they might not be familiar with. And also a lot of communities have difficulty recruiting poll workers because of the amount of labor that's required. So that's all to say that there was a, I think, a not insignificant opposition among many poll workers to those reforms that we mentioned. So I would not anticipate them being unhappy about seeing those rolled back. That being said, it may vary widely from community to community. A lot of the outcry that we did hear was from people who worked in towns or cities where there were just a ton of people that they had to process on election day. And the chief complaint that we heard was this is going to really slow things down. And not only is it going to make it harder for us to process voters, but that's also going to make the lines a lot longer.
Wow. Well, and as both of you alluded to, you don't want long lines because
right.
then you're basically disenfranchising people there. Jessica, I'm really curious what the sort of culture around poll workers is elsewhere. Casey's right. They tend to be older, retired volunteers. It's a long, long day. There's a lot of technology to keep up with. And these days, some contentious interactions at the polls as people are concerned about disenfranchisement and fraud. So who's running the polls in other states, Jessica?
It looks very similar in other states. The vast majority of poll workers are over the age of 65. As Casey mentioned, often struggle with the new technology around voting. And I think that recruiting poll workers and who are qualified and willing to work the entire length of the election is sort of a perennial issue for lots and lots of counties. There are a couple of counties doing really interesting things to recruit poll workers. For example, in Douglas County, Nebraska, the state of Nebraska passed a really interesting law a couple of years ago that allows the state to sort of draft poll workers like jury duty. So you have to serve as a poll worker.
Wow,
like
that's
you would serve
really
on a jury.
Interesting. I'm
going
to cut you off there for just a moment, Jessica. I apologize. We'll pick up after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Time is running out for you to help shorten NHPR's March Fund Drive, while also getting entered into a drawing to win an incredible trip to Anchorage, Alaska, where you can soar above glaciers, stay up late to see the northern lights or the midnight sun. You'll also be entered to win our grand prize, a trip for two to Honolulu, Hawaii, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. Don't wait. Give now to support the news you trust and the NHPR programs you love at nhpr.org.
Clouding up for today. High temperatures in the lower 40s. It'll be mostly cloudy tonight with a mix of snow and rain. It'll end by morning. Lows tonight in the 20s. Tomorrow, partly sunny. High temperatures mid-40s to lower 50s. Friday, cloudy, showers likely, high temperatures low to mid-50s. Then Saturday, mostly sunny for most of the day, mostly cloudy, chance of rain showers in the North Country. High temperatures Saturday, mid to upper 40s. You're listening to the Special Pledge Free Stream on NHPR.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're talking about the many election-related bills here in New Hampshire and major trends around the country when it comes to voting, voting systems, ballot access, ballot integrity. Join us with your questions and comments. What changes related to our elections systems would you like to see? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. My guests are Jessica Huseman, reporter for ProPublica. Her work has appeared in Election Land, ProPublica's collaborative journalism project on voter access, voter integrity, cybersecurity, and so forth. By the way, there's a link on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, to Jessica's work. We've also put a link to our other guests' work, our own Casey McDermott, NHPR reporter covering politics and policy with a focus on data and accountability. And Jessica, you were telling us earlier in the show about the problem that some states have recruiting poll workers. And you mentioned that in one state, I think it was Nebraska, where they're actually drafting people to work at the polls. So give us a little bit more on that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating system. There's only one county in Nebraska that actually takes advantage of that state law. It's Douglas County, which is home to Omaha, so by far the most populous county in the state. But, you know, I was just talking to their election director a couple of weeks ago, and he was telling me that they have absolutely no problems recruiting poll workers at all. They are fully staffed every election, and their poll workers are far more representative of the voters in their communities than what would otherwise happen, right? When predominantly older poll workers have been sort of replaced with much younger, more diverse poll workers. So people feel more comfortable when they go to the polls because they see someone who looks just like them. And I think one other thing that I'd like to mention is that in Hamilton County, Ohio, they did some advocacy to get the required age of poll workers down to 16 so that they could recruit high school seniors, which they've done with quite a lot of success. This county has a pizza party for the high school that can attract the highest percentage of poll workers for their student body, and they see a lot of enthusiastic participation from teenagers, and poll workers there now actively request a teenager at the polls because they can just fly through the technology that's required to process the lines on e-poll books and voting machines.
Wow.
I think that's a really interesting way to deal with the problem of poll workers not really being adept at changing technology.
It's interesting, and so no issues around the fact, Jessica, that 16-year-olds can't vote, but they can still work at the polls?
Yeah, they see this as part of real civic activism. So obviously they're not casting a ballot while they're at the polls, but they are helping people move through the lines and answering the questions that they have about voting. And what Hamilton County would tell you is that they really feel like they're creating a generation of very actively engaged voters, because not only are these people engaging with their community, but they're learning quite a bit about election administration from a very early age.
Wow, real civic engagement there.
Very, a lot of civic engagement.
Well, both of you, we really should talk about one more sort of frontier in these voting debates and discussions that we've been having for a long time, and that's redistricting. And Jessica, just really basic, just remind us what redistricting is and how it's related to the upcoming census.
You know, I think that the easiest way to explain redistricting, so after the census, we have a better accounting of who lives where and how many people live there. And because the House of Representatives and quite a lot of state representatives are assigned proportional to the population, those lines have to be redrawn so that an equal number of people, or a roughly equal number of people, are being represented by a representative, so that, you know, we can really maintain this one person, one vote, and an equal measure of how much someone's vote matters. And so the lines are drawn such that there's this number of people assigned to each person, but they can be drawn in such a way that makes it pretty obvious that one candidate from one party would be elected. You can sort of very carefully draw lines around neighborhoods where you know a lot of minorities live to sort of pack them into a single district so that they can only elect a representative there, or you can crack them. So there's the packing, which I just described, and cracking, which cuts neighborhoods in half and dilutes their vote across two or three even congressional districts. So these lines, entire industries have sort of formed up around redistricting. There are entire companies that you can hire to consult about how these lines should be drawn, depending on what outcome you'd like to see. And we've seen some pretty egregious examples of gerrymandering in places like Wisconsin and Texas, and these are almost always litigated in court.
Well, and many people I've talked to, Jessica, and, you know, very sharp people who follow politics, who follow the issues, who, you know, go to political forums and candidate events, are still surprised that this job of drawing political boundaries is basically controlled by the party in power. People often say to me, wow, that doesn't sound fair. Why do we do it this way, Jessica?
It's been done this way for a long time. And until recently, the Supreme Court has declined to sort of take on the idea of political gerrymandering. They've kind of left it up to the states and called it a political issue that should be resolved there. That may change this year, and they've certainly accepted this case. We'll see how it goes. But, you know, I think that the reason that we haven't dealt with this is because there doesn't seem to be a great alternative right now. Until recently, there was no way to sort of measure how gerrymandered a place was. A law professor from the University of Chicago has created a program called the Efficiency Gap, which sort of measures how much each vote is worth and what would have happened if things were not gerrymandered, which gives us kind of an idea. But without some way to measure how bad the problem is, it's kind of hard to solve. And there are certain states, for example, Arizona was one of the states that was an early adopter of committees doing redistricting in a bipartisan way. And even that has been subject to quite a lot of political rancor.
Oh, that's
and
interesting.
So we saw five states, and it could be four, but I think it was five in the 2018 election also adopt bipartisan committees for redistricting so that they are no longer done on a political basis. So I think we are dealing with this problem now, and it's not clear whether this gets resolved through individual acts of state legislation or at the Supreme Court level. And I guess we'll find out this year.
Yeah, I know there have been some cases before the Supreme Court. Casey, what is happening with the redistricting discussion in New Hampshire?
So there's a lot of movement on this year, but it's important to note that this effort to change how New Hampshire draws up its district lines has been ongoing for a number of years. So this is not just a new issue. I think the most closely watched bill right now is House Bill 706, which is sponsored by Durham Representative Marjorie Smith. And in talking to Representative Smith, I think that, you know, she really framed this issue as almost in her eyes, more important than any of the kind of voter ID or ballot access issues that we've been discussing. In terms of, from her view, it can almost determine a voter's choices before they even step into the voting booth. So she's been doing a lot of outreach to try to win over people who otherwise might be skeptical, including some of her Republican colleagues and including, members of the governor's office who she said she talked to recently.
Yeah, and you've got a little clip of Representative Smith, who, as you say, Casey, feels very strongly about this particular issue of redistricting. Let's hear what Representative Smith said to you about her conversations with the governor's office.
I have had an extensive conversation with two of his well-positioned staff people, and they asked some very thoughtful, probing, serious questions, and we met for way over an hour. And of course that was not with the governor, and it is the governor who counts, but I believe his staff people were doing more than just being polite. Then they could have been polite in 10 minutes or 15 minutes. and thanked me very much for coming, and that would be the end of it. That they asked so many questions, I took as a positive side for how they viewed the bill. And I can't in any way assume that that immediately translates into anything having to do with the governor's position.
That's Representative Marjorie Smith, a Durham lawmaker who, as Casey told us, is leading the redistricting reform efforts at the State House. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Casey, what's the word from the governor's office on this?
So the governor's office is noncommittal right now. Basically, the governor has said previously that he believes the current system works well, but, you know, we'll continue to monitor what the final language of the bill is. I did not get an answer when I asked the governor's office if he's leaving open the possibility of a veto of this legislation if it doesn't meet his standards, which, of course, is a method that he said he plans to use a lot with bills that are sent to him by the Democrat-controlled legislature. Just to hit on very briefly the mechanism that's being proposed here, because I do think it's an interesting one. This commission, there would be an extensive selection process that's laid out in the legislation, but it actually specifically bars people who've been a candidate for elected office, people who've served as an officer, an employee of, or a consultant to major political parties or campaign committees. It bars registered lobbyists. It also bars people who've contributed, large amounts of money to the to federal candidates. So it's really trying to build in a lot of guardrails to insulate the people who are serving on this commission from any undue outside political influence that may lead them to draw districts in such a way that would favor one party or the other.
Well, just wrapping up with both of you, and there's so much more we could talk about, but we did cover redistricting, sort of voter ID, ballot integrity, and then the whole technical issues that both of you talked about at the beginning, you know, sticky machines when it's humid outside. Jessica, to you first, please, what trends are you going to be keeping an eye on nationally?
You know, I think that one thing that I'm definitely going to be keeping an eye on is the type of machines that people choose to buy and how those will impact the way that people vote and the way that voters interact with election administrators, because I think that that's the most sort of tactile way people can be affected at the polling place. I mean, I'm also going to keep an eye on the way that states are responding to concerns over cybersecurity, which I know is not a subject we touched very deeply on today, but I think is an important one as we look forward to 2020, which I can't believe I'm already saying.
Right. Cybersecurity, again, this is related to the concerns that Russia or other countries might try and hack into our systems.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that, you know, one thing that's been really striking to me as I've covered this beat almost for 4 years now is that, you know, the state's relationship with DHS, which is one of the mainline sort of defense mechanisms that we
Homeland
have against
security.
Foreign
yeah.
intervention, yes, is has become a lot better. It is almost striking the way that states once interacted with DHS and how productive that relationship is now. So that gives me a lot of sort of optimism for the way that we'll tackle 2020.
Well, and Casey, which voting or election-related legislation are you going to have your eye on, especially this week? You touched on it earlier.
Yeah, so this week I think I'll be keeping an eye on that that registration act that links the system at the DMV with the election net. But also I think a lot of these just kind of nuts and bolts of how votes are cast and counted. I think that's a really important and really overlooked part of the process. So we'll be doing our part here to make sure that that's better understood for people.
And hope it's not too humid
exactly.
on election day.
Exactly.
Jessica, thank you so much. It was really nice to have you. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
That's Jessica Huseman, reporter for ProPublica. Her work has appeared in Election Land, and we've got a link on our website if you want to learn more. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Casey McDermott, you're always helping us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Casey McDermott, NHPR reporter covering politics and policy with a focus on data and accountability. We have a link to Casey's work as well on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.